Underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. In Gary Steingart's new novel, Lake Success, he tells the story of a hedge fund manager who throws in the towel and flees on a Greyhound bus for a simpler life with his childhood sweetheart. In the novel, Barry Cohen has lost nearly $1 billion from his fund, and the feds are on his trail, and his three-year-old son is diagnosed on the severe end of the autism scale. So Barry hits the road to flee the problems and search for many things, including himself. Gary Steingart is the author of several bestsellers, including Super Sad True Love Story and Absurdistan. His new novel is Lake Success, and it's a pleasure to welcome Gary Steingart to this week's book show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Give us a sense of how you came to Lake Success and ultimately what you were thinking about that put you into the mindset of wanting to write this.
Well, I kind of realized living in Manhattan that there was really nobody left here from the friends that I grew up with. They were all writers and journalists and artists, and they all moved out. So I thought, who was left? And I looked around my borough, and I realized it was mostly people in finance and the people who love them. And so I decided that my next hero, or sort of hero, would become a hedge fund manager and his wife. But I didn't want to write a kind of traditional, you know, novel set on Wall Street. So what I decided to do was to send my character on a bus trip, a Greyhound bus trip across the country for various reasons. He has to get out of town. He's being pursued by the SEC. He has an autistic son that he can't quite cope with. And so he decides to get on a bus and get out of Dodge. And this takes him across the country. So that way I can sort of focus on his psychological state and not just the minutia of being a hedge fund manager.
So in the very basic sense, it is a road novel. You get to experience what many writers have in writing that type of book.
Yeah, one character calls it a middle-aged on the road, middle-aged version of Kerouac's On the Road. I don't know if that's selling it or not, but there definitely is a feel of motion, you know. And I researched it by spending 4 months on the road from June to September of 2016, that pivotal year in American history, starting out in New York and ending up in San Diego.
Through that trip, what were you looking for? What did you want to accomplish in that trip?
Well, first is, you know, I wanted to take care of my character. I wanted to make sure that we got the sense of what it would look like for somebody at the very top of American society, or, you know, the way we celebrate rich people and degrade poor people. But what would it be like to put him amongst poor people? Because the Greyhound is not a fancy way of getting around the country. And I've met many people who use it to get around not just short distances, but basically halfway across the country. So trips that could take 40, 50 hours. But I wanted to make sure that he saw the real America. And I guess the real America is very hard, you know, to quantify, because does that mean that we who live on the coasts aren't real? We're as real as anyone else. But the America that wasn't the 0.01% that is such a part of our culture from our presidency on down, that we, you know, worship people who are in business and think that they can run anything, which they obviously can't.
What was it about the, and for this trip, you took a lot of Greyhound buses, I assume?
Yeah, no, I took the whole way through the country, you know, stopping off in Baltimore and Richmond, Atlanta, Jackson, Miss, El Paso, Phoenix. I mean, I would spend a lot of time in the actual cities, as would my character Barry. So a lot of what happens to Barry is sort of more reportage than the actual use of an imagination on my part.
In that sense, in the reportage, what were the questions that you were asking of the people that you were meeting, of the people that you shared a bus seat with? What were you talking about?
Well, first of all, it was a preview of where this country was going. Because in 2016, when I got on that bus, I didn't think this was going to be, that the country would change so radically that year. I mean, we all thought, well, okay, there's a kind of insurgency candidate on the GOP side, and he's kind of clownish, and that's not going to work out. But along the way, people kept telling me, oh, no, he's going to win. And was surprising. I also got a first taste of white supremacy around Louisiana. These guys got up, and one of them started talking about crucifying Muslims and Jews. And you know, so my character gets off at Shreveport and buys a New Testament coloring book because he's Jewish, as am I. And something like that happened to me as well. So, you know, it was a foretaste of... It wasn't that, you know, people never had these thoughts, and there was the bus was mostly people of color. So speaking very loudly and racistly about things like Breitbart was shocking to me. But I think the shock was not that people had these thoughts. I think they always had these thoughts, but that they were, it was the first summer where people felt like they could get up and voice them. And my character, Barry, is, he likes to put it, a moderate Republican. He's socially liberal but fiscally conservative. And as the novel goes on, you sort of see how his fiscal conservatism doesn't quite add up. He has all these really bad ideas, as hedge fund managers often do, of helping the poor people that he sees. So at one point, he's a watch collector, so he wants to start a urban watch fund to help poor urban kids buy their first Rolex, you know, and other similarly really dumb ideas, which is the kind of stuff that you encounter when you hang out with hedge fund people.
When you are on the bus, you start this trip in June of 2016, you leave New York, and I assume you think, as many people did, that Hillary Clinton was going to be the next president of the United States.
Yeah, I did.
And as you just said, as you started to get into this tour, is when you start to think, well, maybe that isn't going to be the case. Maybe this isn't as much in the bag as it is reported.
Yeah, there were... I remember, and this is an actual scene in the book, as I said, many of my experiences turned into scenes in the book, and this was in Atlanta, Georgia, and I went to a very kind of racist bar in a suburb of Atlanta, and there were these guys showed up, and we started talking about Trump, and they said, oh, he's going to win, and she's going to lose Pennsylvania, and I said, oh, come on, and I pulled up, I don't know, 538, and I said, look, I mean, okay, Ohio perhaps, but they said, no, everyone thinks she's a liar, and she's not going to win, and, you know, and throughout the trip, there were echoes of this, and it was just so surprising. I mean, it almost made me think everyone should get on a Greyhound and go across the country if we want to understand the totality of America. I mean, I understand what happens on the coasts very well, but the totality of America is different and often quite disturbing.
Let me ask you about the role that the election plays in the novel. I was fascinated because obviously the novel isn't only about that, but it does play a large role in it.
Yeah, no, look, I mean... Putting a political gloss on this was not my intention to begin with. I mean, I thought that Trump would be in the background the way things, you know, the way you want to set. If you want to set a novel in a particular time, you'll need some kind of, you know, soundtrack or something to remind the reader of what year this is. And I thought, okay, well, the Trump insurgency is going to be a flash in the pan. Because really what every novelist or almost every novelist wants to focus on are people, you know, characters. And the character of Barry and his wife Seema are where I really wanted to concentrate this. Seema is a very talented woman who is in many ways smarter than Barry, and he kind of knows it. And she's a graduate of Yale Law School and all these different things, but she plays the traditional hedge fund wife role of not having a job and just taking care of their kid. I mean, to her credit, the kid is on the autistic spectrum and he's nonverbal, so there is a lot of work that she does. But so I wanted the book to be a kind of duet between these two characters, one who's running away, who's on the road, and the other who's left behind to pick up the pieces.
In writing that, and I'm going to stick with the election just for a second. So
sure.
You're on the bus and you're talking to people. When you get back and November 8th, 2016 happens and Donald Trump becomes the next president of the United States, you are then left with the task of writing your novel. Did it change it? Did it change the tone?
It changed the tone toward the end a little bit, and, you know, it was a fight. I mean, you know, my editor said, please don't use the T word too many times. Because the thing is, you know, that he sucks the air out of everything, you know, and there's a real danger in writing a book that even has him as a, you know, not a protagonist, but being him in the background, because he wants all of our private time. He does not want us to interact with our friends, our lovers, our spouses, our partners, our children, our parents. I mean, he wants this world to be, in a very authoritarian way, everything is about him, right? So how do you write a book in the time of Trump? How do you write a novel, rather, where you still want people's, you want to explore people's humanity, but how do you do it when there's this giant elephant in the room, you know? And that became, so even though the book, there's more of the T word as the novel concludes, because he does win the election and we go beyond that a little bit. So there's no way, and in fact, it plays into the way these two characters, Barry and Seema, the husband and wife, interact with one another. But I really wanted the book to be also about their kid, who is on the autistic spectrum. And I wanted the book to be, I don't want to say hopeful, but I wanted him to have a journey as well. And I wanted that journey to sort of go beyond Trump. So the novel, I don't want to give away anything about the ending, but there's a kind of, it leaps ahead, so to speak, and it leaves the T word behind a little bit. And that's what my dream is for the entire country, I guess.
The name of the new novel is Lake Success. Gary Steingart is our guest on this week's book show. The book is published by Random House. Did you find happiness, not personal happiness, but of those people that you were talking to, whether it be your character and the ultra rich or the people in that bus station, were you finding glimmers of happiness along the way in this country?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the country's beautiful. I mean, it's a beautiful country.
Right.
And unlike when you're on the Amtrak, you kind of get some view of it. When you're in a car, you see the interstates. But there's nothing really like the Greyhound bus. There were scenes of unshakable beauty going through Texas, through the mountain ranges of western Texas as the sun went down. I mean, wow, it was beautiful. There were many glimmers of happiness. First of all, a lot of people on the bus were the first generation to go somewhere. Many of them were, I talked to people who were going to college for the first time. At the University of Texas, El Paso, and there's a huge El Paso chapter, I met professors who were teaching the first generation of students and from either El Paso or from across the border in Ciudad Juarez in Mexico. So throughout there were huge glimmers of hope. And it didn't feel at that point, I mean, Trump was somewhere in the background, but it didn't feel like the country was completely off the path. I mean, when white supremacists got up and were able to dictate to the rest of us what the conversation would be and people pretended to fall asleep or look out the window or something, nobody stood up to them. You know, that was a great foretaste of the fact that those people, those white supremacists on the bus would eventually make their way into our government or the people that they would vote for. And so there were glimmers of both the awfulness that would overtake America, but also of the incredible, incredible beauty and hope in this country.
You talk about at the beginning that the inspiration was this realization that your friends had been exiled from the city of New York because they could no longer afford it. So
sure.
With that in mind, what did you learn? And what did you learn in helping to answer some of those questions as to how and why did that happen?
Well, I mean, as I said before, I mean, I don't think that Manhattan is kind of the nexus of happiness these days, because most of the hedge fund people I met were not very happy. They were endlessly competitive. Nothing was ever enough. They were moated and estranged from their communities, their families, their children, I mean, everything. You know, they lived an existence that was just about a couple of spots on the map in Manhattan, their fund, their gigantic apartment, et cetera, and their club. And, you know, the friends I have who have left New York are the happiest people I know, you know, and they went to Berlin or parts of California or Washington State or, well, a great deal of them moved to the Mid-Hudson Valley, which is where I spend about half of the year. Sort of in the Rhinebeck Hudson type of area,
right.
And there's like there's a growing contingent of writers and artists there who are incredibly happy. I mean, you leave New York, you buy a very nice house with a nice plot of land, and you have fellow people to talk to. Some are even crazy enough to commute to New York every once in a while, even though it's, from Hudson, it's what, almost 2-hour ride. But they find it worthwhile in order to in order to live someplace where, which isn't as toxic as Manhattan has become, I guess is what I'm saying.
What was it like for you to write a novel like this so soon after writing a memoir, of writing autobiography?
Yeah.
And putting yourself out there and then suddenly looking at something that is ultimately, as many novels are, very personal.
Well, the interesting thing here was that it was the first novel that I had written that did not have a protagonist who was exactly like me, you know, a Russian Jewish immigrant from the former Soviet Union. And I mean, Barry's Jewish, so, you know, we're taking baby steps away from the usual stuff. But but he was different from me. He's wealthy. I'm certainly not. He's he works in a field that I did not, you know, well, actually, when I was a kid, I grew up poor in Queens, and I you know, Wall Street was this glimmering sort of thing that, you know, you thought, wow, I'm being bullied as a kid in my local school, but one day we just wait, you know, I'll make a lot of money and I'll show everyone. And that, by the way, was the sort of the MO of a lot of the hedge fund people I met. You know, they grew up lower middle class on the peripheries of stuff, and they wanted in. And Wall Street, I mean, really, in our country, Wall Street and tech are the only two industries where you could really attain immense wealth. And so that part felt familiar to me, but it no longer really jived with the kind of person I am now. But that kind of ambition, I mean, I went to a math and science high school called Stuyvesant High School in Manhattan, mm-hmm. one of those very selective schools, and it was almost all immigrants. That was the last time I'd seen this level of competitiveness, I think, in a long, long time.
You do write about being a father, though, in this novel. Was that something conscious?
Of course. In a way, I wrote that memoir, Little Failure, because I wanted to write everything down before I forgot it. You know, I'm 46, but Russians don't live that long. So I kind of wanted to get a lot of this stuff down for my kid, because I realize now there's somebody who will one day, you know, read this stuff and try, who will probably say, oh, God, I want to figure out who my dad is. Why is he so weird? And I wanted to write that down, and I did. But then I also, the experience of fatherhood, which is something I really didn't think would ever happen to me. I always thought I would not have kids, but I did. And the feelings of both intense love and anxiety were something that just washed over me from day one. And they wash over Barry, too. And, of course, his kid is disabled, and Barry has a lot to work with. And of course, he, being the schmuck that he is, at least at the beginning of the novel, he runs away from it all. But, you know, I mean, he's on a journey, too. It's not just a journey on Greyhound across the country, but it's a journey as a father toward a place that hopefully is not one of just fear and anxiety, but of understanding and love. And those are really, you know, it's tough when my gene pool is all anxiety. I come from possibly the most anxious part of the world with the most anxious parents. And, you know, I was just, you know, I mean, I am a walking commercial for Ativan and Xanax and stuff like that. So for me, writing about a father like that was, I don't want to say cathartic, because art shouldn't be cathartic, but it did feel like, oh, okay, this guy, I know what he's talking about.
Very early in our conversation, I wrote something that I just looked at in the margins of my notes here, and I just want to get back to it, because I think it's interesting that you said when you were on the bus, it was both you and Barry traveling.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that, the differentiation for you of just not the reportage that you talked about, but the fact that you were actually traveling with this guy.
Yeah, no, it was really fascinating. I would say, okay, Gary doesn't exist. I'm gonna erase this guy. How does he feel about everything that's being said? How would he talk to the people around him? I mean, I talk one way and I talk very shyly. Barry is, you know, he wants to prove that he's the most social person in the world. So he's, you know, he just sort of calls everyone out, wants to talk to someone, actually ends up hitting on this woman on the bus and having a kind of relationship with her. So I kept thinking, okay, I'm not going to do any of this stuff, but what would Barry do? And how would people respond to that based on the kind of people that I met? So, you know, I do a little bit of journalism, but I'm one of the shyest journalists around, because I really, I have journalist friends who just, you know, they just launch into a conversation with anyone they meet. But for me, it's a little more tentative. And in the Greyhound bus, the way you start a conversation is that everyone wants to plug in their iPhone because you don't want to focus on the fact that you're on a Greyhound bus. You want to escape to another world. So everyone is always figuring out which outlets work and which outlets don't to charge their, because, you know, you could be on a 15-hour trip, so you're going to need to charge your iPhone. So the most of the conversation began with somebody saying, hey, can I borrow your outlet? Does it work? You know? And so that's how I made my acquaintances was through the fact that I always made sure when I got on the bus that I had a working outlet and that, you know, when people needed it, they would be able to chat with me. So it was a very sad attempt at communication on my part.
Again, we don't want to give anything away here, but my God, I love the ending to this novel.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about how you reach an ending that is satisfying for you and is, because one of my things of reading contemporary novels is often just it's really great until the ending, and that you pull off such a beautiful ending in this is amazing to me. So I, without giving too much away, and I know that's hard, but give us a sense of how you reached what I assume for you was the successful ending.
Yeah, I do like the ending. You know, and my friends who read it debated sort of, is this a happy ending or is this an unhappy ending? And you know, my thought is that endings are should be kind of ambivalent. You know, what's the real ending? We die, I guess.
Right.
But, you know, an ending should also be about the fact that we're alive now, that every day is, that if you choose to love each day, you can't. You know, there's no one saying you can't do it. And so Barry is somebody, again, who's plagued by anxiety and fear, who doesn't understand his beautiful, smart wife, who doesn't understand his autistic but also very complicated kid, you know, and whose complexity grows and grows, and whose complexity really is what the ending is about in many ways, without giving too much away. And for Barry to begin to understand that complexity is really what the ending is. In some ways, does he redeem himself? Because this man is part of this man has caused harm to the world through his work, through the fact that he's you know, basically participated in insider trading, through just the inequality that's perpetuated by being in a hedge fund, by working for a hedge fund, in his personal life with the way he's treated his wife, and certainly running away from his kid at one point in the book. But if he doesn't get redemption, can he at least get a chance at redemption? Can he at least see what the contours of redemption could look like? That's what I wanted for Barry.
Does taking a trip like this and writing about it and understanding this country and many issues that help make us Americans, does understanding that more help in your anxiety in any way, shape, or form?
Well, you know, I don't know if it helps my anxiety. It helps my sense of wanting to fight for what we have. Again, as I've said, the American experiment, look, it hasn't been an unmitigated success. We've done, this country is built on some horrible foundations.
Right.
Horrible. And we all know what they are. And these foundations are, again, you know, they're not no longer foundations. They're a part of the building. We can see them now, you know, and it's very unfortunate, very ugly. So my anxiety has not abated, but the sense of wanting to, because this is no longer just my country, it's my son's country too. You know, as a writer, if I didn't have a family, I could live anywhere in the world. I would just, you know, hightail it to a beach in Burma or something and enjoy life quite a bit and, you know, and focus on writing and not think about things. But this is his country. This is, and he has to grow up here. I want the beauty. I want him to be able to witness the beauty with, and there will always be ugliness, but I want that balance shifted, and I want to go back a little bit in time. I know it's hard, and I know it is impossible, but we have to fight for something now, and he has to fight for something. It's not even political, you know. I mean, I think the environmental issues, which will have political outcomes, will dwarf anything that we can imagine now. I mean, you know, if you know, my son was born recently, he's 4 years old, so, I mean, he will see very tangible effects, especially living on a coastline, you know, of what the world will bring. And so what can we do? I mean, the tasks are so huge. But giving up is really not an option. And going across the country, you see exactly what you have to fight for.
Gary Steingart's new novel is Lake Success. It is published by Random House. Gary, thank you very much for being
with
us. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at WAMC.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Thanks to Argo Studios and Paul Ruess for their production assistance. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.